Hong Kong Advanced Level Examination, Use of English, Section A, Listening Test, 2005. Instructions to candidates. You should have on your desk a question answer book. Do not open it until you are told to do so. I repeat, do not open the question answer book until you are told to do so. Now write your candidate number, center number, and seat number in the boxes provided on your question answer book. You are reminded that all examination materials will be played once only. The test is divided into three parts. You should use a pencil to write your answers for all three parts. At the end of the examination, when you're told to stop, put down your pencil and close your question answer book. You may not leave the examination room until you are instructed to do so at the end of the examination session. No one may leave early. Put your hand up now if you have any difficulties. It is not possible to handle complaints after you have taken the test. Now look at your question answer book. Check that your question answer book has no missing pages. Look for the words end of test on the last page. The test is about to begin. Keep your earphones on until you are told to take them off. Now look at page 1 of your question answer book. Introduction. Situation. You are part of an editorial team working on a special magazine to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. The theme of the magazine is memories of what life in Hong Kong was like during the Japanese occupation between 1941 and 1945. As part of your research, you are interviewing two elderly survivors who were children during the war years, Hong Kong Chinese citizens who emigrated after the war but who have returned for the anniversary. Part 1. In this part, you'll hear the survivors talking about the situation in Hong Kong before the Japanese occupation began. You'll now have 2.5 minutes to familiarize yourself with the note headings for Part 1. At the end of Part 1, you'll have 2.5 minutes to tidy up your answers. Thank you.
Testing, testing. Okay, I think it's working. Let's get started straight away, shall we? My name is Antonia Lee, and this is my assistant, Max Brighton. Thank you all for agreeing to be interviewed for our anniversary magazine.
Yes, yeah. No problem.
Our pleasure.
And perhaps we can start by finding out a few basic details about how old you were, where you lived, and what you did during the occupation period.
Sure. Well, I was born in 1930 and lived in Wan Chai until I was 15 at the end of the war in 1945. I then moved to Manchester with my family, and that's where I've been ever since. I worked as a stable hand at Happy Valley during the war.
Mm.
It wasn't unusual to work at that young age, but it was unusual for a girl to be a stable hand.
Mm. How about you, Robert?
Well, I was only 7 when the occupation started in 1941. But even so, I had to work on my father's boat. He was a fisherman. So I guess that's what you should put down for my occupation. And we lived in a village on Lama Island. That's spelt with 2 M's, by the way.
Yes, I know. I live there.
And like Nancy, I emigrated a few years after the war. I went to live with an aunt in London.
In Chinatown?
Of course. Just like Nancy, I guess.
Nancy, you said your mother worked at the Jockey Club. What did she do exactly?
I've got her old residence identity card here. Look. I'm afraid some of it got smudged. Probably in the rain or something, but you can still see 1 or 2 details.
What sort of details are missing then?
Well, don't forget that Chinese lines should be read vertically, not horizontally.
Of course, and one reads from right to left, isn't that so?
Yes. So, if we start at the top right-hand corner, you see where that smudge is?
Oh, with the handwritten number below it, 1, 3, 7, 3, 8, isn't it?
That's right. Well, that's the registration number.
Let me just make a note of that. Registration number.
The next line in says residence card, and then it gives the details of where she came from below, the place of origin.
Mm-hmm.
Then the fourth line in from the right is, well, I suppose you could say present address. You can't really see it now, but as I said, we lived in Wan Chai.
Yeah, yeah.
Line 5 is for occupation, and if you look down at the bottom, you can just make out that it says seamstress in Chinese.
Oh, yes, in brackets.
Yeah. She used to help make and repair jockey outfits. That's how I ended up working at Happy Valley. Now, to the left of occupation, you've got full name, though you can't make that out at all. It's so badly smudged.
And what's that at the bottom, next to the big square chop?
Oh, that's for date of birth.
And these lines on the far left, with the official chops?
Oh, that's the registration authority, or certification, that kind of thing.
Wow, that's really interesting. Thanks for showing us.
Okay, let's think about the situation in Hong Kong in the months before the Japanese invasion. Is it true that Hong Kong was full of spies?
Oh, yes. There were spies everywhere. Let me tell you a story. One day, I was collecting shells on the beach, and this group of Japanese Boy Scouts appeared.
Boy Scouts?
I say boys, but these were the oldest boys I ever saw. They were way too old to be scouts. You know, their uniforms were too small for them. They were obviously very uncomfortable in them. Then some of them... some of them were even smoking. Hey, one of them even offered me a cigarette.
And what did they do, these elderly Boy Scouts?
All sorts of interesting things. I mean, for a start, they all had cameras, all 6 of them. So anyway, they took photos of the beach. And when I say the beach, I mean the whole beach, from one headland to another. Several of them also had notebooks, and when I got close enough, I could see they were sketching the area in these notebooks. the surrounding area, the high points, the low points. Finally, there were a few who had plumb lines.
Spelt like plum, the fruit, you mean?
Yes, but with the letter B at the end. You know, the special lines with weights on the end that fishermen have. The scouts used them to measure the depth of the water, you know, to see how deep it was.
Ah, I realise now what it was they were doing.
Yeah, it's easy to say that in hindsight. But at the time, I couldn't make sense of it at all. What they were doing was seeing if the beach was suitable for landing.
Landing?
Yeah, you know, landing troops. But I don't think they ever did in the end.
Was there anything else you remember that was suspicious on the island?
Oh, yes. There was Creepy Cheng, the Taiwanese farmer.
Taiwanese?
Yes. He arrived in mid-41 and set up this little farm at the far end of the island, away from all the villagers.
And what was suspicious about him?
Oh, lots of things. The fact that he spoke with a strange accent was one of them. Yeah, his pronunciation was very strange. You could only pick up one or two words. Then there were his hands. He had very smooth hands. My father used to say Cheng's were hands that hadn't worked the land. The most suspicious thing, though, was his radio. One day a friend and I followed him back to his house and heard him using a radio.
Surely there was nothing unusual about that.
I'm talking about a radio transmitter, not a receiver.
Oh, a transmitter. So what do you think he was doing then?
Reporting ship movements, I reckon. He had a great view of the entrance to the harbour from where he lived. He would have been able to see Navy ships going in and out very easily and report on their movements.
What about you, Nancy? Were you aware of a Japanese presence in the city at all?
Oh, sure. But in the city, I think it was a bit more subtle, you know. I used to have to walk through Wan Chai on my way to work, and I noticed one or two things about the Japanese bars there.
Such as?
Well, drinks were always cheaper in the Japanese bars. 10% off on beer or something like that posted in the doorway.
Why was that?
The bars wanted to attract soldiers, of course. Soldiers, sailors, whatever. And the girls who sat outside these Japanese bars, the bar girls, they spoke very good English, at least better than the other bar girls. They would call out to the soldiers and say, "Hey, come in, have a drink, have a chat."
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason for this was, I realised this later, was that they wanted information from the soldiers. I mean, what seemed like unimportant stuff at the time, like what brigade are you from, where are you stationed, that sort of thing.
Oh, I see. And with one too many beers down them, the soldiers might give away something important.
And I remember now, some bars offered a photo service. You know, send a photo home to your family. I sometimes saw a Japanese photographer taking a group or an individual photo of British soldiers outside a bar. Of course, the troops would get a copy of the picture, but the real purpose behind this service was to get photos of different units. I mean, military or navy units serving in or visiting Hong Kong.
It certainly sounds like you were a very observant 11-year-old girl. I guess you must have been pretty anxious about what would happen in the future.
Well, I'm not sure I really knew what it all meant at the time. I suppose I just focused on everyday things, you know, like going to work, and I couldn't help noticing if there was anything different. I can't say I was really all that interested at the time, though I could tell that my mother wasn't very happy. She developed all sorts of nervous habits and became very protective of me.
I know exactly what you mean. You know, we were only children. I could tell that my dad was also suspicious about the number of Japanese in Hong Kong. He used to rant and rave a lot. But, to be honest, I laughed when I saw those Boy Scouts on the beach. What's the Boy Scout motto? Be prepared, isn't it? Well, those guys were prepared, all right. only for seaborne invasion, not jolly songs and sausages around the campfire.
Okay, let's move swiftly along the timeline to Christmas 1941 then. What were you doing on the day the invasion started? Let's start with you, Robert.
Unfortunately, I was in the harbour. We were on our way to a fish market. And as we were sailing through in my father's boat, I saw people at the Kowloon post office shooting at the staff ferry as it left the pier.
Japanese soldiers, you mean?
No, they were triad gunmen, what you call fifth columnists, recruited by the Japanese. They were shooting at the staff ferry as it pulled out. The ferry was packed with people trying to get to safety on Hong Kong Island.
Wow, there must have been a terrible panic.
And what about you, Nancy? Where were you?
I was working at the stables at the racecourse in Fan Ling, and I saw the most amazing thing on the second day of the invasion.
What was that?
Well, we were just getting the horses onto trucks, you know, getting them onto trucks so we could evacuate them to the island, when a platoon of Japanese troops appeared on the far side of the golf course that was also up there in Fan Ling.
That must have been terrifying.
Oh, it was, yes. But in fact, they weren't really interested in us. They just ran to one of the bunkers, you know, the sand pits on the course, and they began to dig up these huge pieces of equipment.
Artillery pieces for the big guns. I remember hearing about that. They were buried by Japanese visitors weeks before the invasion started.
Oh, bother.
What's the matter?
I think the batteries are running down on the tape recorder.
Well, let's have a rest while you put some more in.
That's the end of part one. You'll now have 2.5 minutes to tidy up what you've written. Part 2. In this part, you'll hear the survivors talking about the early years of the occupation. You'll now have 2 minutes to familiarise yourself with the note headings for Part 2. At the end of Part 2, you'll have 2 minutes to tidy up your answers.
People often say the most positive aspects of the early years of the occupation were to be seen in the area of health. Do you remember anything about that?
Oh, sure. That was a big deal in the early years. I suppose the main thing was the inoculation drive against cholera and smallpox. Everyone had to be inoculated, and I don't think anything on that scale had been attempted before. Oh, and then there was enforced cleaning of streets.
Enforced street cleaning?
Yeah. There were these squads from the Bureau of Health, or whatever it was called. They used to come round and make sure the houses and streets were spotless. If they found any dirt or refuse, punishment was bound to follow.
Mm. Oh, and I remember the drinking water was improved. There was some water tank construction project that the Japanese started on, something the British had promised but never got around to.
Yeah,
the drinking water was much better in the city.
For us kids, though, the most exciting thing was the war against pests. I mean vermin, flies, mosquitoes, anything that was a health risk. In my village, the campaign was actually called the War Against Pests, if I remember rightly. George Bush would have liked that.
Presumably there were health risks attached to actually catching some of these things.
Yes, that was the ironic thing, of course. Catching flies and such like meant exposure to disease.
And it wasn't just disease you were exposed to. Mm. If you wanted to catch rats, for example, the best time to do that was at night, which meant that you could be shot because you were supposed to be indoors then.
Shot by a soldier?
Oh, yes, a soldier or a street guard. Well, worse than that, you might be attacked by dogs.
Strays, you mean?
No, army dogs. There were specially trained Alsatians released by the army to patrol the streets at night. People were terrified of them, and for good reason.
Yeah.
Okay, let's turn to the subject of money. You said something about having a little collection, Robert.
That's right. I left this box here for safekeeping with my aunt, and I picked it up just the other day.
So what goodies have you got in your box of mementos?
Loads of money. Look! My wartime savings. Or rather, my father's.
That's quite an assortment of notes. Can you just run us through them?
Sure. Let's call them exhibits, shall we?
Okay.
All right. Exhibit A. A 1941 mint condition one Hong Kong dollar note.
And what about this one? Let's call this one Exhibit B. Yen. That must be Japanese, isn't it?
Yes. A very high denomination yen note. And a special one, too, as it's actually military yen. Compare it with Exhibit C here. A lower denomination yen note with no English writing on it.
What about this other one here with the wise-looking Mandarin on it? Exhibit D, shall we say?
Exhibit D is very interesting. If you look at the bottom corners, you can see it's a yuan note. Exhibit E also has a Chinese sage on it.
Oh, yes, but what amount is that? I can't even say that number. It's monopoly money, isn't it?
Well, sort of, yes. In fact, it's hell money.
Oh.
And you've got one more there, haven't you? Gosh, it looks really old.
Yes. Exhibit F, the pride of my collection. A pataka, or Macanese dollar from 1912.
Yeah. That's quite a range of notes, I must say. And I understand there was quite a bit of variation in the value of these currencies over the period of the Japanese occupation.
That's very true. Let's take them one by one, shall we? And I'll see what I can remember. Exhibit A, the Hong Kong dollar. A dollar would have bought you a fair amount before the occupation. Dollars were still legal tender and still worth something. But the new governor devalued the Hong Kong dollar. In fact, it was a government policy to devalue it right from the start. My father hid his dollars in his fishing boat. He had a secret compartment in the hold. He hid them there in the hope that they might regain their value one day.
And did they?
Of course. After the occupation, only Hong Kong dollars were accepted. No other currencies were allowed.
What about Exhibit B, the military yen? Were they useful?
At the beginning of the occupation, it was the best currency to have. One military yen was worth
$4 at one point.
How come they were worth so much?
The value was inflated. I mean, it was inflated so much it was hard to believe.
And what did people use it for?
Well, like most people, my father used it to pay taxes. Property, food, entertainment, you name it, the Japanese taxed it. And they only accepted payment in military yen. At the end of the war, it did still have some value, surprisingly, because the British offered to exchange it. People could exchange a limited amount for dollars.
What about the real yen, Exhibit C? Could you use that in Hong Kong?
Officially, it wasn't accepted. But in reality, it did have limited value. People used it for bribes. They bribed the Japanese for all kinds of things. My father used it to get a fishing license. Getting a fishing license was almost impossible without some kind of bribery taking place. At the end of the occupation, real yen was worth nothing in Hong Kong, though. Nobody wanted Japanese notes. In fact, they spat on them. As for Exhibit D, the mainland yuan, this had no value in Hong Kong at all.
Why was that?
Because it was only used in China. You couldn't even bribe anybody with it. However, as a fisherman, my father often made illegal trips to the mainland. When things got really tough, he used this money to buy goods there. When the occupation ended, this kind of yuan became completely worthless everywhere.
Is that so?
Well, you see, it was issued by a Japanese puppet bank.
A pocket bank?
No, puppet bank. As in little wooden toys on strings. Certain parts of China were under Japanese control and were known as puppet states.
Now, you can't convince me that hell money, I mean Exhibit E, was of any use.
Not generally, perhaps, but in many villages it was of value. Only for a couple of months or so. The village elders decided that hell money could be used because there was a shortage of real money when the Japanese invaded. The elders gave each note a real value, and my dad used it for trading in his and only within his village. But after the crisis was over, hell money didn't have any value again, at least not for living people. Hell money was only for the dead after the occupation.
And so, to Exhibit F, the pataka?
Completely worthless at the time, I'm afraid.
Because it was only valid in Macau?
No, because it was out of date. My father had a lot of these, but he didn't look too carefully at the dates, unfortunately.
How did your father hope to use them?
Oh, he tried to escape to Macau with us. A Macanese fisherman had offered to take us for money. I can remember this guy saying, "This money was good for passage in the First World War, but it won't get you anywhere today." Of course, at the end of the war, it was still out of date, but even more so.
Yeah. That's the end of part two. You'll now have 2 minutes to tidy up what you've written.
Thank you.
Part 3. In this part, you'll hear the survivors talking about the closing years of the occupation. You'll now have 2 minutes to familiarize yourself with the note headings for Part 3. At the end of Part 3, you'll have 10 minutes to tidy up your answers for the whole paper.
So, we reached the closing months of the occupation, and from everything I've read and heard, this was really one of the worst times in Hong Kong's history.
Yes. Even people with a lot of money suffered in those days. There was hardly anything to buy, and if you did buy something, you had to be careful you were getting what you'd paid for. The smaller villages were generally okay, because you could trust people. There were a lot of shopkeepers in town who made a small fortune ripping people off. They tampered with the food. You know, I cracked my teeth so many times on rice, for example. There'd be these little clear stones in practically every mouthful. They were put in there to increase the weight.
At least that wasn't as dangerous as ground glass. I remember once taking a last sip of tea and feeling this stuff rasp over my tongue. It had been mixed in with the sugar.
No.
You know, I like my tea sweet, not crunchy.
Oh, and then there was the sand, of course. That used to end up on all kinds of things, especially bran, as it was the same colour.
Another way of increasing the weight was to add water. My mother always warned me to dig my hands to the bottom of a bag of flour before buying it, just to make sure it wasn't damp at the bottom.
Yeah. And of course, anything liquid was very easy to adulterate. One time, my father, he spent some of his hard-earned military yen on a bottle of brandy, only to find out it was cold tea.
With or without a spoonful of glass.
And I'll never forget my mother's rage when she found out she'd been feeding my baby brother soybean extract rather than full cream milk.
Speaking of milk, that reminds me of one or two other things unscrupulous profiteers used to do. Tinned milk was replaced with mud, for example.
Eh?
Yes, the milk was carefully drained out and the mud put in its place.
Oh, and do you remember the incredible disappearing soap, Nancy?
Oh, yes.
What?
Soap was made with too much water. So after using it two or three times, It just vanished.
Yes.
And what about the matches without heads? You know, you'd buy a box of matches, get them home, and find there were no heads on the bloody things. And then it was my sister's wedding. And Dad bought this new pair of leather shoes for me with some of his yen and...
I just know what you're going to say.
Anyway, it rained on the day, and those shoes just melted into a soggy mess on my feet. Leather shoes? They were made of paper, my friends.
Oh, no.
Plain, ordinary paper.
Okay, let's talk about some of the more general kinds of problems that are common to any wartime occupation, which civilians are most affected by. I've listed them here so we can keep them all in our minds. Perhaps you can tell us how serious these problems were. Robert, let's start with you.
By punishment, I suppose you include execution, torture, and so on. Well, I know many terrible things happened. But punishment wasn't really foremost in my mind as a boy, and I knew how to stay out of trouble. So I suppose punishment was near the bottom of my fear list.
And assault and rape?
Well, for me, that would be in the middle of the list. Say number three. From time to time, I saw a few people get hit with rifle butts when they got in the way of soldiers. But nothing more serious than that. I was lucky, I guess. No, my single worst fear was deportation. Periodically, the Kempeitai, the Japanese military police, rounded anyone up who looked homeless and derelict, loaded them into boats, and dumped them on the China coast or on islands out at sea. One night, we almost got stranded on Beaufort Island, or Lo Chow, as it's known in Chinese, where some of the deportees had become cannibals. Mm-hmm. That was the most terrifying night of the war for me, and I'm still haunted by it. Mm. I would rather have starved than ended up on Beaufort. Mm. And starving was a genuine prospect, even though my father had ways of keeping us fed.
You haven't mentioned bombing.
I was coming to that. I suppose we should have been more scared than we were once the Americans began to bomb shipping. But I tell you, as a boy, the sight of those B-29s appearing over the southern horizon was incredibly exciting. I really looked forward to the bombing raids, so I wasn't scared at all.
That's so strange, you know, because for people in the city, bombing was terrifying. I'd put it second on my scale of seriousness. Central was badly firebombed once, and one of my friends was hurt when a Star ferry was attacked as it was crossing the harbour.
And you'd put deportation at the top of the scale, would you?
No, that's the other strange thing. Deportation was actually made to sound attractive, mm-hmm. especially to Hainan Island, where the Japanese said there was work and food enough for everyone. I suppose I was too young to realise it was all propaganda. Punishment, I suppose, was more of a concern to me than deportation, because I did see it practised outside the Wan Chai police station by Japanese soldiers. But for a teenage girl, of course, assault and rape was a worse fear, even if it was less likely to happen. Nothing, not even bombing, came anywhere close to my fear of starvation, though. I saw famine victims practically every day lying dead in the streets.
But how did you cope?
Well, sometimes the jockeys gave us food. If we looked after the horses well, or ponies as they were in the last few months, the jockeys would pass on food as a way of thanking us.
We kept a supply of dried fish hidden away. My father carefully concealed some of the catch if he could, smoked it, and hid it in a box in the cellar. I can still taste that fish if I think about it.
But wasn't one of the problems a shortage of firewood? So even if people did have food, they couldn't cook it.
That's right. Some of us at Happy Valley were lucky, though. We got hold of some wooden horses and used them for firewood.
Wooden horses?
Yes. After the last ponies had been killed and eaten, the authorities had these miniature wooden horses made. They were pulled round the racecourse on wires.
You're joking.
I'm not.
On Llama, the forests had been stripped bare of wood, so there was nothing substantial to burn. So my father collected driftwood. Driftwood is wood you find floating out at sea or washed up on the beach.
And what about rampaging soldiers? You know, soldiers who are looking for trouble, that kind of thing. How did you deal with that?
If there were drunken soldiers in your village, for whatever reason, families would make a noise to scare them off. People used to bang pots and pans, anything they could find, really. It was a bit like chasing away evil spirits, which I suppose, in a sense, was what we were doing.
How about you, Nancy?
Basically, you did whatever you could to avoid attracting attention. For example, you cut your hair short and kept it short, you know, like a boy's, and you wore drab clothes.
And what about avoiding deportation? How did people manage to do that?
Well, for example, you always had your papers in order. I mean, your ID card, like the one I showed you earlier. Mm-hmm.
Then, if you could manage it, you carried a little bribe money with you, some military yen.
Let's go back to air raids. What did you do when the planes came over, Nancy? I know there were some air raid shelters around.
Yes, but there were only a few, and many were closed to locals. We just hid in our basement. Yeah. We were lucky to live on the ground floor, and as soon as we heard sirens or the sound of the engines, we all ran down to the basement.
Mm-hmm. It still must have been a terrifying experience for you. How about you, Robert?
As I said, shipping was always at risk. But my father had a British flag hidden on his boat. So when the bombers flew over, he spread the flag on the deck of the boat. The pilots would look down and see the Union Jack just spread out there on the deck. Once, I even saw a bomber tip his wings at us.
Let's move on to August 1945, the recovery of Hong Kong by the British. What are your overriding memories of that day, the 30th of August, when the Royal Navy sailed into Victoria Harbour once again? Robert?
My friends and I knew the British fleet was coming, so we kept watch from a hillside for several days. Look, I've got this map here, and I can show you roughly what happened.
Okay.
It's a recent map, but the geography hasn't changed much since 1945. So anyway, just as some of the fleet began to sail between Beaufort Island, the island of my nightmares, and the Stanley Peninsula, that bit there, where Stanley crops out into the sea, well, to our amazement, these three kamikaze speedboats suddenly appeared in Sokuwan Bay. You know, Japanese suicide boats. Shinyo, I think they were called.
You mean you actually saw them, the ones hidden on Llama?
Yes, though no one ever believes my story. Especially when I tell them that I saw those boats get blown right out of the water. You see, the suicide boats got about halfway to Up Lay Chow, you know, the little island off Aberdeen that's now a huge housing estate, and they were just beginning to head towards the cover of Chung Hum Kok. At least that's what we imagined they were going to do, when they suddenly disappeared in a great fountain of water. I tell you, that was some shooting. We just screamed for joy. There were some villagers who had been forced to dig the caves, you see. The caves where the boats were hidden, and they were killed, so the location could be kept secret. So it was an eye for an eye, I guess.
And how about you, Nancy? I imagine there were great celebrations in the harbour when the British sailed in. People out in boats flying flags and cheering and such like, just like in Europe.
Actually, it wasn't like that at all. In fact, the battleships were the only vessels in the harbour. There wasn't even a Star Ferry to be seen. Everyone kept off the streets, too. I think people, and I'm including myself when I say people, were so physically and mentally battered, they were in a state of perpetual worry.
Mm.
There was no rejoicing. There wasn't that feeling of salvation, I think, that Europeans had. The belief that everything would be all right from now on.
Well, as we all know, Hong Kong survived it and has gone on to achieve great things. Thank you very much for talking to us, Nancy, and thank you, Robert.
That's the end of part three. You'll now have 10 minutes to tidy up your answers. Keep your earphones on until you hear the announcement at the end of the 10 minutes. That's the end of the test. Stop writing now and put down your pencil. Close your question-answer book and leave it on the desk in front of you for the invigilator to collect.